It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On board this hour from our pool of esteemed political analysts from around the state, we have Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College, joining us by phone from Mount Vernon, I assume. Hello, Hans.
Hello.
Wayne Moyer is with us from Grinnell, where he is a Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Well, let's jump right into it. Coming up a little bit later this hour, we want to talk about how much we should be worried about Donald Trump's aversion to daily intelligence briefings, how to deal with the conflicts of interest relating to his global business empire. Of course, as his cabinet picks sort of wind up, there are very few slots left. We'll have an analysis of the latest cabinet picks by the president-elect. But first of all, let's start off with this question. How much did Russia tamper with our elections, and did it matter? I'd like to have you join in our conversation this first half hour. Your reaction to the leaked CIA report that Russian hacking was aimed at boosting Donald Trump's candidacy, and your reaction to Donald Trump's dismissive reaction to that CIA assessment, an assessment, by the way, not shared by the FBI, which, along with other U.S. agencies, has concluded that the Russian cyber attack sought generally to undermine the election. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook and leave your comment or question. Well, the past few days, President-elect, the nation's intelligence agencies, the two major parties have become embroiled in an extraordinary public debate over what evidence exists that Russia's president moved beyond mere espionage to deliberately try to subvert our democracy and pick the winner of the presidential election. On Monday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he supports a congressional investigation into intelligence community findings that Russian hackers attempted to influence the election.
Any foreign breach of our cybersecurity measures is disturbing, and I strongly condemn any such efforts. Prior to the election, the Director of National Intelligence released a statement saying that the Russian government directed the recent compromises of emails from U.S. persons and institutions, including from U.S. political organizations. That is what the intelligence community believes can be said in unclassified remarks without risking sources and methods. Anything else, is irresponsible, likely illegal, and potentially for partisan political gain. I agree with Senator Schumer, Chairman McCain, Burr, and others. This simply cannot be a partisan issue.
Also, the top name in the U.S. House, House Speaker Paul Ryan, backs an investigation, writing on Monday that exploiting the work of our intelligence community for partisan purposes does a grave disservice to those professionals and potentially jeopardizes our national security. Donald Trump dismissing this as partisan. Let's go to you first, Wayne Moyer. What is the story here of you're seeing of how Russian intelligence hacked into the DNC and RNC, but actually used the DNC information they got against Hillary Clinton?
Okay, let's start with what we know and what we don't know. We know that the Russians hacked into the DNC. We also know that much of that hacking came back in the political campaign, and that most of that that came back from WikiLeaks was adverse to Hillary Clinton. Though they hacked into the Republican National Convention, there was nothing that came out in the campaign that was from WikiLeaks that was adverse to Donald Trump. We don't know for sure what Russian motives actually were. That's an element of speculation. One element is they're just trying to disrupt the American political process, perhaps to undermine the legitimacy of democracy. Another possible explanation is that they were tilting directly toward Donald Trump. We don't know for sure what their motivation was. We are sure that they did not compromise the actual voting process. I think we've got pretty strong evidence now that the ballots themselves we're not compromised. So I think that's where we are in terms of what the Russian involvement was.
Mm-hmm. As when I saw a headline, I think, in the progressive online magazine Slate, it said the voting system was not hacked. The voters were hacked is one way of interpreting, I guess. Hans, how do you see this? It's incredible that, according to the CIA report that was leaked, Russian hackers could roam freely through the DNC's network for nearly 7 months before the top officials in the Democratic National Committee were alerted to the attack, before they hired cyber experts to protect their systems.
Yeah, I think this is concerning for anybody that's that has an interest in the democratic system here. But at the same time, I think what Wayne is saying is right, that this we need to emphasize that this is not a change in the outcome, right? This is not the Russian officials are hacking into the voter systems or in some way subverting the integrity of the ballot. This is merely them trying to insert themselves into the conversation and using perhaps some devious means to get information that might be useful.
Yeah, but when you say merely, Hans, merely could also mean that one of several factors that tipped the vote in favor of Donald Trump.
Yes, but I think that's the difficult thing to say, whether or not that is actually the deciding factor. Right? If you look at what we know, for example, about media coverage and what effect media coverage can have on an election, the media coverage does not have a huge effect. I mean, maybe it's enough to tip the election one way or the other, but most likely not. Right? Most media effects are fairly short-lived. They don't have a large influence. Yes, they can influence. They can change priorities and they can change how people are perceiving the election. But to say that the election, the outcome, is entirely due to Russian hacking, I'm not sure that's the right way to put it. Nor am I. I think that they have an interest in the outcome, and perhaps they're trying to influence this just like any other individual would want to influence the outcome of the election and using the means and resources that they have. I think the difference here is that the means by which they were getting this information is illegal, and that's the concerning point. And I think that we should focus on that aspect rather than the change of the election. And I think that really what's happening here is you see this kind of political – turning this into a political football, which I think is the problem. If this was just about hacking – I think that everybody would say we need to get Russians out. But because this has become turned into a political issue where it's focusing on the integrity and the outcome of the election, then you get Republicans pushing back saying this is not something that we really need to look into.
Mm-hmm. So we heard Mitch McConnell say, well, in breaking with the president-elect, Donald Trump, on Monday, he said there is the reason for more scrutiny about this. So, Wayne, when we talk about this, there are different types of investigations. So what do you see in the making?
Well, there certainly will be an investigation in the Senate Armed Services Committee, which is Senator McCain's committee. And Senator McCain has taken quite a tough stance in general toward Russia. I think the question is there a broader investigation? Would there be a national investigation with sort of an open outside counsel, for instance?
Mm-hmm. How do we make sure? Because it's all about the integrity of our election system, right? And what the goal then has to be that this investigation cannot be seen, have the appearance, or be in any way partisan?
I think that's right. And then the results then will have to be made public. Now, the administration is doing its own investigation, but with either the administration or Congress, there's always the issue of to what extent politics gets into this. And if you have an outside independent, like the 9/11 investigation committee doing this, then you get away from either side, either political party trying to influence the result.
Do you see it going that way, Wayne?
I think at this stage, no. I think there is a resistance in the Republican leadership that something like this conceivably could come up with some results that would undermine the Trump presidency.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Hans Hassel of Cornell College, as we talk about the recent politics and specifically the reaction to the leaked CIA report that Russian hacking was aimed at boosting Donald Trump's candidacy. That's the CIA's conclusion, not the conclusion of some of the other intelligence agencies in the U.S., not the FBI's assessment at this point, as far as we know. Gail is in Des Moines. Gail dialed 1-866-780-9100. Hi, Gail. What do you want to chip in?
Hi. I think we're ignoring the elephant in the room. The reality is that Deborah Wasserman-Schwartz, Donna Brazile, Podesta, they were all caught undermining our democracy. Russians weren't caught undermining our democracy. They exposed it. And I'm sure we spy, they spy, we're going to hack, they're going to hack if it's possible. It's going to happen. But the undermining of democracy didn't come from the Russians. It came from Donna Brazile. It came from Deborah Wasserman Schwartz, and it came from Podesta.
Okay, what do you think about this, Hans, the idea that Gail puts forward that it's really no problem revealing that perhaps the Democrats had their thumb on the scale for Hillary Clinton against, say, Bernie Sanders in the primary process?
Well, I think going back to what Wayne was saying about congressional investigations, one of the questions that I have from all of this is, right, where does this lead? Right, if this was the government agency, they would put out some expectations of changes that needed to be made. But you're dealing with non-government entities here, right? The Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee are not not governed by government, by government bureaucracy, and so it's hard to say what exactly would come out of this. Now to the question, right? Is this undermining democracy? I think that the question is, are they taking illegal action? I mean, I think that we can say yes, perhaps what Wasserman Schwartz did was not perhaps in the best interest of the party or in the best interest of the organization. But I don't see that as anti-democratic. But I see or even illegal. Right? What Wasserman Schwartz was doing was perhaps objectionable to a large proportion of the Democratic voters, but at the same time, it's not illegal. With the hacking, that is a very clearly an illegal action, and the question then becomes, right, how do you take action as a result of this? Parties getting involved in primary elections is not something new. This happens all the time. It happens in Senate races. It happens in House races. You merely have individuals with resources that are trying to coordinate together to back up a candidate that they see has the best chance of winning.
Okay, let's go to our caller, Jim. Thank you, Gail in Des Moines. Let's go to Jim in Dubuque. Jim, welcome to the program. What do you want to chip in?
Well, I want to ask why this is so much worse than when a Senate investigation showed that the Obama State Department sent money and personnel to Israel on behalf of Netanyahu's opponents and tried to influence the election that way.
Okay. Jim, thanks for the question. I'm not sure. I don't know the details of that. Wayne Moyer, can you answer Jim's question in Dubuque?
I don't know the answer to that, but I think the fundamental question here is, to what extent do we want to allow a foreign government to interfere directly in our electoral process? There's also an issue of whether the United States should intervene in a foreign electoral process, and we have done it sometimes in the past. But I think there's a very fundamental question here.
Mm-hmm. Hans, go ahead.
I think the key difference here is that there's an illegality question here. I think that this is entirely right that other entities have an interest in involving themselves in elections. The U.S. has an interest in involving itself in elections elsewhere. And may do so. They may, right, they may campaign on behalf of an individual. They may, right, do a whole number of different things. I think the concern here is the illegality of the hack. Right, the accessing private information without consent is essentially the equivalent.
We take espionage among countries between countries as a given, don't we, Hans? Well, how is this different than espionage going on for hundreds of years?
I think the difference is that this is us, and we view this as illegal. I think that what Jim was the caller was referring to was, it was not something that was explicitly illegal or explicitly an act of espionage. I think that's the key difference. I mean, I think that any political actor who has an interest in the outcome is going to take whatever actions that they can. And the question is, should there be some punishment for this, right? Just as there was a punishment to Nixon and his aides for breaking into the DNC in the 1970s, right? There needs to be punishment for illegal actions. We punish other spies from other countries when they are caught in performing espionage. That's the same exact thing. Espionage is a given. The process is the key aspect here is to defend yourself against it and to realize what's going on and to prevent it from happening again.
Well, if I could quickly add on that.
Yes, Wayne.
It's not the espionage that's at stake here. It's the releasing of the results of the espionage in a political campaign to try to influence the political process. That's what I have real problems with.
Mm-hmm. Well, far from being punished yet, Vladimir Putin, just seeing this just out, topping the Forbes 2016 list of most influential people, this for the third consecutive year. So there's, I guess, a sort of reward for Vladimir Putin. let's go to Peter in West Des Moines. Peter, welcome to our program.
Hi. Well, my take on this is the fact that what could the Russians have actually done to influence this election, because it's not like anything they could have said if they had presented something in the news media would have changed someone's vote in this country. But on the other hand, I think the director of the FBI definitely affected this election. He shouldn't have said the things he did. It was clear that he wasn't a Hillary supporter. And, you know, that may have damaged this and changed people's minds.
Okay,
more
Jim.
Than anything the Russians could have done.
Okay, Jim, thanks for your view. Yeah, we had a whole host of, I mean, in the month after, look with hindsight at the election results, we had a whole host of things. We had Hillary Clinton's weakness as a candidate being put forth. We had her private email server controversy, the public statements, as mentioned there by the FBI director, about her handling of classified information. So, Hans, we will never know. There is no way to unravel this, and no, is there?
I think that's right. Right, a campaign and an election is full of so many moving parts that it's often hard to identify exactly what's going on. But what we do know, I think that the caller made a mistake here in asserting that what Russians say makes a difference. I agree with it. What Russians say probably is not going to have a huge influence on the average American voter. However, what the New York Times says or what CNN says or what Fox News says or what any number of these outlets say, National Public Radio says, does have an influence. And so this influence doesn't flow directly from the Russian espionage to the voter, but rather through the mediator of the media. The media picks up on this information that's released through WikiLeaks, reports on it, and then that subsequently has an influence in the process. And that's really where the concern is that this change in the focus of the media affects how voters perceive the election. And like I said earlier, there's big questions about how much influence the media has and how big of an impact that they can have. They do have an impact. The question is it enough to make a difference in the election? And that's, we can't really know.
Here's an interesting comment in the form of a question in an email from Andy, our listener in Marion. Is Russia's ability to influence the election a reflection of a failure on the part of American popular media to prioritize veracity over sensationalism? That is, maybe Russia would have a harder time influencing America if the American journalistic institution was stronger. What do you think about that, Wayne? How much blame?
Well, I think there is something to that argument, the media clearly picked up on the WikiLeaks stories that came out, and it influenced the way that they framed the debate and the way that they were covering the debate.
Did they have a choice? Can you have these leaks and sensational leaks from deep inside the DNC and just keep quiet about them as a news organization?
No, you can't keep quiet about them, but how big do you build them up? To what extent do you question them? Do you raise questions in terms of, well, to what extent is this diverting us from the real issues? I certainly agree the media needed to report them, but I think sometimes it went overboard and without asking questions about really what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Hans, your view of the media's role here?
The media plays a huge role in framing the context of how we're making a choice. This question of is the news cycle speeding up so much that media outlets are now prioritizing scoops over factual evidence. I this is not an area of my own expertise,
okay.
Unfortunately, but I think it's a legitimate question, right? It fundamentally has changed in the last 15 years from how journalists operated, and the question is. Does that make a difference? One thing that I do think is interesting, with these different media outlets, you've changed the set of gatekeepers to the American public, right? You've changed what becomes news, right? We didn't have Breitbart and Drudge and HuffPost and all of these other outlets that have access to people now before. And so the range of people that are the medias through which politicians communicate to voters has fundamentally changed, and I think that makes a difference in how media is, how news is framed.
A question quickly before we have to go to break here in a couple minutes. What do you make of Trump's stated position that we can't know who was behind this? This despite the consensus of 17 intelligence agencies agreeing that Russia was involved in that effort. It was the CIA that is saying that it was to the end of electing Donald Trump, but the others all agree the Russians were. What do we make of this, Wayne, that our president-elect does not listen to the consensus view on this by 17 of his own intelligence agencies?
I find this actually quite worrying. I think the fundamental question here is to what extent is the president listening to the advice of his intelligence people? And reacting so quickly and so negatively makes you wonder about the extent to which he really is listening to what they say and trying to evaluate what
mm-hmm.
they say.
Is it, Hans, take this, is it that he sees it so much as a possible threat to his legitimacy that he doesn't even want to go there?
I think that's right. I think he used it as a partisan issue that cast doubt on his electoral victory, and that's right when you're trying to pass policy and generate a mandate. That's difficult. If that's going to stop that perception of that.
Okay, we're going to come back in just a minute, continue with our Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News with Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College, and Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, where he's Rosenfield Professor of Political Science. We hope you'll join us as well. In the next half hour, we want to talk about Donald Trump's aversion to intelligence briefings. He says that, I'm a smart person. I don't have to be told the same things in the same words every single day for the next 8 years. That's a quote from Donald Trump. What do you think about that? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook. Back with Wayne Moyer and Hans Hassel in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, a conversation with Jim Leach. Jim Leach served 30 years as a Republican member of the U.S. House of Representatives from Iowa, senior member of the House Committee on International Relations, among other things. Tomorrow, he's speaking before the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council over the noon hour. That's why I'm going to have a conversation with him later today that will be recorded and aired tomorrow. If you'd like to have your question for Jim Leach included in that program, please email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Once again, your question for Jim Leach, email it rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Politics Wednesday with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College and Hans Hassel of Cornell College, picking apart the latest on the political landscape. Turning now to Donald Trump's aversion to intelligence briefings. Trump, the president-elect, is receiving an average of one presidential intelligence briefing a week, as far as we know, far fewer than most of his recent predecessors. But his vice president elect Mike Pence gets briefings around 6 days a week, we are told. In a conversation with Fox News host Chris Wallace on Sunday, asked the president-elect about this. He defended his decision to forego daily intelligence briefings, opting instead to get them once a week.
Well, I get it when I need it.
But is there some skepticism?
First of all, these are very good people that are giving me the briefings. And I say, if something should change from this point, immediately call me. I'm available on 1 minute's notice. I don't have to be told, you know, I'm like a smart person. I don't have to be told the same thing and the same words every single day for the next 8 years.
Now, in an interview with Trevor Noah of The Daily Show on Monday, President Obama expressed concern over President-elect Trump's decision to only attend what are supposed to be daily intelligence briefings, only attend them once a week.
It doesn't matter how smart you are. You have to have the best information possible to make the best decisions possible. And my experience with our intelligence agencies is that they are not perfect. They'd be the first to acknowledge that, but they are full of extraordinarily hardworking, patriotic, and knowledgeable experts. And if you're not getting their perspective, their detailed perspective, then you are flying blind.
Flying blind. Hans Hassel, what do you make of this aversion to daily intelligence briefings? I'll get it when I need it, he says.
Well, I think it's interesting. I saw a tweet recently that Trump had tweeted out that he was complaining that Obama had not was not getting daily intelligence briefings. I think this is just a matter of prioritizing what's important to you at the time, and that was an opportunity to slam the president on anything when you're in the opposition, and now it's a chance to justify your actions. I think things change, and I think it's interesting that he's not doing this. I'm not sure I have a grasp on what is contained in those briefings to know whether or not this is a problem or not, but there's some evidence that suggests that this may be something we should be concerned about.
Wayne Moyer, I know you have a long view of this going back decades of presidents, and they receive briefings in different ways. And the intelligence community says, Mr. President, any way you see fit to receive these briefings, we'll accommodate, right?
No, that's certainly correct. And most presidents have sought absolutely all the intelligence that they can possibly get. Recognizing that they're going to be held responsible for the final decisions, and if something happens that they don't know about, then ultimately that could come back to hurt them. And so I think that there's a real risk for Trump. Now, granted, he's not in office yet. He's not yet responsible for decisions. And my suspicion is that when he is in office, he will probably take briefings every day.
Mm-hmm. Just to throw in here on your point, Wayne, former CIA Director Leon Panetta has just said that the president-elect risked being blamed after any potential attack on the U.S. if he refused to receive more regular intelligence briefings. Here's a quote from Panetta. I've seen presidents who have asked questions about whether that intelligence is verifiable. What are the sources for the intelligence? But I have never seen a president who said, I don't want that stuff. Now, I don't know if that's a fair characterization of what Donald Trump has said there. Hans, jump in.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I mean, I think this is really an electoral decision. And I think that we learned this all throughout the campaign that Donald Trump is not a typical electorally oriented politician, or he views elections in a much different way. And so I think that this is, I mean, it sounds as though from these other quotes, this really is about, or you want this information so that you can then, you know, react accordingly so that your electoral vulnerability is not exposed. And I think that this maybe should be that Trump doesn't recognize this, that he doesn't perceive it as an electoral need. And it may come on later that he says, I do need this information for a variety of different reasons. And I think that Wayne is right to point out that he's not yet the president of the United States and so doesn't have an absolute necessity to have this information in order to react to it.
A lot yet to get to in this hour of politics Wednesday with Hans Hassel and Wayne Moyer. Let's do some quick hits with the phones. First of all, Sean in Iowa City, what are you thinking?
Yeah, well, thank you for taking the call. A long-time listener, first-time caller, and
welcome.
But this is very poignant matters, and it really comes down to more than just U.S. politics here. It's really more of a geopolitical stance, and President-elect Trump is more interested, less in being a servant of democracy here in the U.S., but advancing some business agendas. And it is in Russia's interest to have global warming thaw the Arctic Circle so that their northern ports can help transport oil. And all of the revenue that supports the Russian government and the Russian national budget, it all comes from the majority of it comes from oil. And so there are clearly, with the choice of cabinets that are cabinet officers who are adverse to climate change policies, and putting all these people in place, he could care less about security briefings, because he's trying to create a coalition of cabinet members and strategic geopolitical partners to advance business.
Okay.
And everything else is out the window.
Okay, Sean, thank you for your view from Iowa City. Let's talk about Trump's pick for Secretary of State, I think referred to there by Sean there in Iowa City. Rex Tillerson, his work at Exxon as CEO. Senators are reacting to the nomination. Yesterday, the president-elect named him the head of Exxon as his choice for U.S. Secretary of State. He won the backing from some Republican foreign policy figures, despite his ties to Russia. Some lawmakers worrying about his links to Moscow and opposition to U.S. sanctions on Russia, which Russia, by the way, awarded him a friendship medal in 2013. On Face the Nation on Sunday, Senator John McCain, Republican, expressed reservations towards Rex Tillerson's appointment. He said he would get a fair hearing, though, from the Senate.
It's a matter of concern to me that he has such a close personal relationship with Vladimir Putin, and obviously they've done enormous deals together, that would color his approach to Vladimir Putin and the Russian threat. But that is a matter of concern. We will give him his chance. That's what the confirmation process, that's what advise and consent is all about.
Senator John McCain. Wayne, why not have a friend of Russia, someone who has worked with Russia for decades in this position?
Well, there could be advantages to it. He knows Russia. I think the question, though, is how closely his thinking is aligned to oil interests. Can, having been 40 years for Exxon, can he now become Secretary of State and look at what's going on in terms of Russia objectively, as opposed to what has been his focus up until now, which is find as much oil as he can in as many places as he can and working with whatever leaders he happens to find. And I think that's a serious question that will have to be talked about in the Senate hearing.
Mm-hmm. Hans, so the question is there, how well does he change hats? How much of an overlap, too, is there between the skills needed as a CEO of an international oil corporation and the skills needed by the U.S. Secretary of State?
Yeah, there's always a concern that the people coming into government at a, you know, when you have an outsider elected as the president, whether they're really going to have a good sense of how the bureaucracy functions and how government functions. You saw this with Jimmy Carter in the 1970s as well. A lot of the people that came in to government with Carter were outsiders who didn't have a good sense as to how the system worked and how to accomplish things that the team wanted to get done and made some mistakes that were avoidable if they had somebody in there that really was experienced. And there's that same question here of Tillerson. Does he have the experience needed, or can he get the people around him that will help him to work things the way that they should, so there isn't a rocky transition?
Okay, let's talk about another recently announced appointment or a designation by Donald Trump, tapping Rick Perry of Texas to head the agency that Rick Perry once forgot. Let's go back in time to 2011, a Republican primary debate before the 2012 presidential election. Then candidate and former Texas Governor Rick Perry attempting to name three federal agencies he would eliminate if elected as president. But he was only able to name two.
But you can't name the third one? the third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third. Sorry. Oops.
Okay, the so-called oops moment that has been remembered for a long time, unfortunately, for Rick Perry. About 15 minutes later in that debate, Perry said he meant to say that he would eliminate the Department of Energy, which he is being tapped to head now by Donald Trump. Your view, Hans?
I think it's an interesting choice. I think that this fits very well with some of the other nominees that Trump has named so far. If you look at his appointment to the Department of Education, Betsy DeVos, and you look at Perry, right? They're both individuals that have views on these departments that are largely in line with the with standard conservative views on these departments. And so, while perhaps it's ironic that Rick Perry gets appointed to name a department that he couldn't remember on the campaign trail 4 years ago. At the same time, I think that the ideological choice fits very well.
Mm-hmm. Could I just raise another point here?
Sure.
The Department of Energy handles the country's nuclear weapons. It doesn't impose them in battle, but it's responsible for development and maintenance and things like that. And so it's not a trivial agency.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so eliminating it? Well, where would all those necessary duties go?
I think
go?
That's a serious question as to what would happen. I don't think people want all of the nuclear research and all of that to go back to the Defense Department.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the continued concern about conflict of interest with Donald Trump for at least a couple of weeks. We have waited for the date Donald Trump set a couple of weeks ago to explain in a press conference, or at least an address, how he would address his business conflicts of interest prior to assuming the White House. The date was to have been December 15th. That's tomorrow. Trump canceled those plans. Instead, he delayed that announcement until sometime in January, before the inauguration, January 20th. Trump transition officials say the president-elect wants to have more time to give his address because he's been occupied with filling out his cabinet, some top administration officials' positions. Late on Monday, though, this week, Trump tweeted that he would be leaving, quote, leaving my businesses before January 20th so he could focus full-time on the presidency. He added, two of my children, Don and Eric, plus executives, will manage them. No new deals would be done during my terms in office. End of the tweet, quote, from Donald Trump. Hans, how is this going to be dealt with? We have Donald Trump estimated to control some 500 companies across many industries spanning the globe.
Yeah, this is a serious concern because his business dealings could actually run in violation of the Constitution, and that's what's called the emoluments clause or the ineligibility clause. It's in Article 1, Section 6 of the U.S. Constitution. Basically, says that individuals can't serve in businesses that receive things from foreign governments. And they're concerned here. The framers were concerned about corruption. And if he's continuing to be involved in these businesses, and if he still continues to own them and to operate them, then there's concerns there that. That might come in violation with Trump having properties all over the globe, and in properties in Washington where diplomats may stay. Right, this is a concern just because it's a constitutional concern.
Mm-hmm. Is there a solution that will remove all of these concerns, Wayne? Can you see one?
I think the only real solution would be for him to divest all of his holdings and turn them over. To someone to administer them who had no connections to the administration. And
can he turn them over to his children or his son-in-law?
No, because you can't separate yourself from your children. And he'll still be talking to his children. And there's talk that he wants his children to be advisors even in terms of his administration. And so I think I don't think that would work.
Mm, okay. Let's talk about the Electoral College vote, that coming up on Monday, December 19th, 538 members of the Electoral College slated to meet in their capitals, also here in Iowa, to cast the only official vote for president. Now, getting back to the numbers, from about a month ago, Trump won the popular vote in states that carried 306 electors, while Hillary Clinton won states that included 232 electors. Remember, it's 270, 271, that the magic number there. Now, anti-Trump forces are working to persuade some Republican electors to turn on, to turn against Trump, block his immediate election. This is a group of at least 10 members of the Electoral College writing an open letter this week. Here's a small quote from that open letter. Trump's willingness to disregard conclusions made by the intelligence community and his continuing defense of Russia and Russian President Vladimir Putin demand close scrutiny and deliberation from the Electoral College. Hans, any chance that these, well, they are almost all Democratic electors, could somehow throw a wrench into the works before inauguration?
Yeah, the only way that this would work is if they this group of Democratic electors could somehow coordinate on a Republican alternative that would be satisfactory to the to those Republican electors that are dissatisfied with Donald Trump. I'm not sure that that's going to happen. I've seen rumors that there are about 20 or so electors that are considering voting for somebody else. That's still not enough. Most likely, most of those will not actually do take that action.
We have to remember, don't we, Hans? The electors are the party faithful.
Yes, exactly. These are people that have been appointed generally by the parties, the state party organizations themselves. And I'm not even sure that we'd want something like this, right? Because if for example, I'm a strong Democrat that really does not want to see Trump in office, and I am concerned about this, and so I mobilize these electors to not vote for Donald Trump, and lo and behold, some of them don't, and no one gets a majority in the Electoral College. What happens next? Well, the vote then goes to the House of Representatives. And the House of Representatives doesn't vote by individual, but by votes by state. So each state gets one vote. If you look at delegations the state delegations, a majority of them are controlled by Republicans. So what you end up with is most likely a Trump presidency. Anyway, regardless of what the electors do. Mm-hmm. And once that happens, we've essentially violated a norm that we've had for a long time, and that becomes problematic, right? All of a sudden, you have perhaps reasons in the future for other norms to be violated or other problems, and that's a concern that I think that we should be careful about violating this due process, because it may lead us to a less democratic procedure than we have now.
Wayne Moyer, do you see it the same way?
Oh, I agree with Hans. I don't think this is going to happen.
Mm-hmm. But sure, okay, so Wayne, short of the goal of stopping Trump from being officially voted in as president, what is then the goal of these Democrats? Simply to delegitimize Trump from the very first day?
That may be part of it. I think part of it goes back to the sort of broader question as to what extent you want to really rely on the Electoral College, or should it be the popular vote that really decides who gets elected president? Now, I don't have any way of knowing exactly what their motivations are, mm-hmm. but with Hillary Clinton having won the popular vote by, it looks like now, more than 2.5 million votes, I think there are questions in a lot of quarters in terms of how do you handle this disconnect between the electoral process, the Electoral College process, and the popular vote process.
Less than 2 minutes left. I wanted a quick comment from each of you about where the Democratic Party finds itself. We've been focusing, of course, on the GOP. They have unified government in Washington now. As Donald Trump's inauguration draws near, Barack Obama leaves office. Where are the Democrats as far as you see them? Hans, are they prepared, unified, to fight the president's new agenda?
Well, they've got a power gap in that party right now, and they're struggling to find who will that be. Will that be Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader? Will that be Nancy Pelosi? Will that be someone else? And that's often very difficult when you don't have a clear hierarchical leadership position in the range of elected Democrats. And I think that's something that's going to have to get worked out in the next couple of weeks. And I'm sure that we'll get worked out, but it's a lot harder to mobilize and coordinate when you don't have a clear a clear leader.
Okay, Wayne Moyer, what do you see as the position of the Democrats
at
this point?
I agree with Hans. I mean, the Democratic Party in recent years was so linked around Hillary Clinton that it's in complete, I think, disarray at this stage of the game. And they're going to have to find new leadership, and they're going to have to find it quickly. And that's and they're going to have something in place before the congressional election 2 years from now.
Okay. Thank you very much, Wayne Moyer. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College. Hans, Wayne, what a pleasure to have you this hour. Thank you so much for your insights.
Ben, it's been great.
Thanks so much.
Okay, and thanks to our listeners for their input into this conversation. A reminder again, my conversation with former Congressman Jim Leach. He served Iowa in Washington for 30 years tomorrow during the noon hour. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.